The Theosophical Society presents Helen Zahara in a talk entitled The Expansion of Awareness.
There are many people in the world today who believe that there is nothing other than this physical universe or collection of universes. And their view of all sentient life, including man, is an entirely mechanistic one. They equate man with his brain and body and think that that is all there is of him. And yet there are others who have had enough interior experience to lead them to the conviction that behind this empirical world of ours, there is another world, both enfolding and sustaining it, which cannot be explained in terms of our normal frame of reference. It's like trying to explain to a two-dimensional being what it would be like to have a third dimension of awareness. If you had met a flatlander who had awareness only on two dimensions, his whole universe would simply be flat, and he would be able to move only in two directions on the flat surface, left or right as the case may be. That would be his whole universe as far as he was concerned. And if we tried to explain to him what it would be like to have a third dimension of consciousness, that is to add height and depth, he would not be able to understand. He could never comprehend, because there would be no standard of comparison. Similarly, there have been people who have been able to enter a more comprehensive state of awareness than the ordinary one which most of us knows. Mystics, seers, poets, musicians, scientists, artists, clairvoyants, ordinary people have testified to the truth of the larger world of the inner self, which cannot be communicated in words completely. These experiences are not to be equated or cannot be called simply hallucinations or imaginations of deranged brains, and cannot be equated with them. Long ago, Plato described the dilemma in which most of us find ourselves because of our circumscribed state and limited awareness, implying how much more there is in the universe than we mostly can sense. In his Republic, he gave the example of prisoners chained in a cave to face the wall so that they could not see the sunshine outside the door of the cave, or the people and the life that went on outside. Behind them was a fire which cast shadows on the wall, thus creating silhouettes of themselves and shadows and silhouettes of others who passed by. This was their only world. They lived simply, according to this example, of course, they lived in a world of shadows and silhouettes. For them, that was the only reality. It was their total existence. And they could not imagine, and no one could possibly describe to them, the world that lay outside the cave. Men and women passing by, other objects, the trees, mountains, as well as the depths of space. How difficult it would be to understand. In the same way, it is possible that each one of us is a prisoner in the cave of our little world of appearances, limited by our five senses and by our mental impressions, memories, desires, prejudices. The cave of each one of us is varied according to our education, religion, environment. In some cases, it is wider because of our ascetic experiences. In some cases, narrower because of our lack of opportunity and our conditioning. Could it be that we too are focused in a world of images and shadows, which are real as far as having to live in them is concerned. We can't escape from that world. But in terms of the life of the soul, this world may represent only a small part of existence, and there may be a much greater and wider state of being than we have yet discovered. We know, of course, that we are living today in a time of youthful revolution, in which thousands, maybe millions of young people are seeking this wider awareness. They are taking trips, as we know, with various types of hallucinogenic drugs. Some of them are really in earnest and seeking. Some may do it from curiosity. Now, the drug experiences have demonstrated for some users the possibility of heightening sensory perception, or dissolving the boundaries of the personal ego, of feeling a sense of unity and love. On the other hand, there are others who've testified that they've had frightful experiences which have engendered fear and horror and have led to even fatal consequences. The psychological state of the person seems to be part of the reason as to what type of an experience comes. But the problem is that the experiencer cannot choose the type of experience as to whether it will be good or bad. And he cannot stop it at will. And so he has, in a sense, set aside the ordinary control of the mind and the will, so that out of the unconscious flood feelings and impressions which normally have been dammed up and which perhaps would not come out otherwise except in dreams or under psychoanalysis. Now, whatever comes, whether it be beautiful or ugly, there does not seem, as I have said, the possibility in most cases, there may be exceptions, of stopping the experience and saying, this is enough, I will not go further. And in some cases, it has been known for the experience to return unbidden at some later date, because the individual has experienced some disorientation and has lost control of the situation. Of course, I may sound like a square in this respect, but only recently, some of us here have heard the news that the two young people whom we know, who were experiencing with drugs, were found dead after prolonged use of psychedelic drugs and wrong psychic experiences. Several of us had seriously warned the young man, but he had ignored our words, assured us that he would know when to stop. He said, I'll know the danger signals, I won't go too far. And he even went to the length of keeping a diary of his experiences. Unfortunately, he did not stop. His wife died first, and then he hung himself under the experience of drugs. Now, surely there must be other ways which are more true and which can be controlled more satisfactorily. Apart from the possible dangerous effects of drugs, we cannot take a pill and expect to reach spirituality. We cannot take a pill like an aspirin and reach the spirit, the reality. What is needed is a way to unlock the potential richness of the inner self, which means self-transformation. This does not come by a passive, negative method, not by letting the psyche take over, but by conscious realization in a dynamic state of awareness, an affirmation of the inner spiritual self. We would probably all agree that our waking consciousness is not a full expression of ourselves. We are aware of the world around us, of other people, through our senses, and therefore we have a growing awareness according to our experience. But the information that we receive through our senses is colored, conditioned, and viewed first of all, according to our interior psychological state. Our emotions and feelings color our reactions to everything around, to objects, to people. We don't like the dress someone wears, or the style, or the color of his skin. And so we have a reaction comes up, and our awareness, therefore, has a barrier brought down. We don't even know that person as he really is. In addition, from our emotions, there well up deep feelings of joy or despair, affection or hate. Our desires of attraction and repulsion. And then, of course, there are our thought processes which begin working. Our memories, our anticipations, our worries, our calculations. Now, if we observe ourselves and watch this process taking place, we can watch these thought processes occurring, and we will realize how trivial most of them are. And yet, there are times when the process of thought reaches great heights. There is an ability to synthesize and to realize abstract concepts. Great discoveries can be made. And in this realm of thought, we begin to ponder upon meaning, upon purpose. This is the functioning of pure reason as compared with the more mundane thought action. Psychologists have discovered various levels of awareness which have been given such terms as subconscious, superconscious, subliminal, and so on. And all these are considered as part of the general field of the unconscious. And from these states arise dreams, locked up fears, hopes, fantasies, and the drug experiences. It may surprise you to know that the Eastern cultures recognize a much wider spectrum of conscious states than does Western psychology. Lama Anagarika Govinda, in his book, The Psychological Attitude of Early Buddhist Philosophy, enumerates at least no less than 121 conscious states known to Buddhist psychology. In Hindu thought, going back into the mists of time, there has been a school of Vedanta philosophy in which has been presented the concept of two natures in man. There is the outer or empirical nature, which is ensnared in the sense world with its struggles and suffering, and an inner imperishable self, the Atma, which is immortal and untouched by outer circumstances. In one of the beautiful writings of the Vedas, the Mundaka Upanishad, we find these two selves likened to two birds of golden plumage, inseparable companions. The individual self and the immortal self perched in the branches of the same tree. The former tastes of the sweet and bitter fruits of the tree. The latter, tasting of neither, calmly observes. The individual self, deluded by forgetfulness of his identity with the divine self, grieves and suffers. But when he recognizes the other bird as his own true self, he beholds his glory and grieves no more. In Western thought also, there have been, among various existential philosophers, as well as depth psychologists and some theologians, the idea of a deeper self, though not as comprehensive a concept as that of Vedanta. Man is seen by many of these scholars as no longer to be simply rational, sexual, and instinctual. There is recognized that man has a hunger for wholeness, a drive to actualize, to bring out all the potentialities of his consciousness and its expression in our daily lives. And this may well be what many young people are trying to do. There's one area of awareness which I have not yet mentioned, which is now being tested and recognized by parapsychologists, but is by no means accepted by psychology as a whole. And this relates to the fascinating field of extrasensory perception. It's not many decades since it was believed in Western thought that there was no other way of obtaining knowledge except through the recognized channels of sense, that is, sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell. Then scientists working in the field of parapsychology began to discover that the mind can and does traverse space. Mental telepathy works, clairvoyance works, observation at a distance and through things, not necessarily by way of the senses. Of course, the possibility of extrasensory perception has long been experienced and spoken of. There are references to it in the Bible. There are legends relating to the oracle in Greece and so on. But at the end of the last century in the West, it was regarded as hocus-pocus and was reduced to demonstrations in the music hall, often accompanied by a certain amount of theatrical charlatanism. However, since the 30s, serious study of extrasensory perception has been undertaken, and it has been found that there are those who can communicate telepathically over long distances, who can see things that are hidden to most of us, and who display other methods of awareness. Another experience not related to the senses, of course, is that which occurs during sleep. This suggests another area of awareness which is by no means fully understood. Now, the theosophical philosophy also postulates a dual self, which at the same time is one. We have the concept of an immortal divine self, which is a fragment of the consciousness, the all-pervading consciousness of the universe, the divine mind, God, call it what you will. This immortal self, so it is said, projects part of itself into the phenomenal world of existence through a personality, and this personality, of course, is transient, mortal, is born and dies, but the true inner self remains. Although this personality is changing, moving from youth to old age, yet it is linked to the undying immortal self. This being the case, in moments of inspiration, of mystical experience, it is possible to have flights of consciousness which enable one to become aware of the inner immortal reality. Or to put it in another way, if we open ourselves to hear within, the inner self will be heard. It will inspire us and open our minds to new and greater depths of awareness. Beethoven mentioned this possibility when he said about himself, quote, "You will ask me where I find my ideas. I hardly know. They come uninvited, directly or indirectly. I can almost grasp them with my hands in the open air, in the woods while walking, in the stillness of the night, early in the morning, called up by moods which the poet translates into words, I into musical tones. They ring and roar and swirl about me until I write them down in notes. There's a great expansion of consciousness. This is an inspiration. The opening of the door of perception to admit the beauty and greatness of the inner self. Likewise, there can come great leaps of the mind by which important discoveries can be made and great ideas arise. Einstein spoke of this possibility when he wrote, "The mind can proceed only so far upon what it knows and can prove. There comes a point where the mind takes a leap, call it intuition or what you will, and comes out upon a higher plane of knowledge, but can never prove how it got there. And then he says, all great discoveries have involved such a leap. Now, many mystics of the East and West have testified to expansions of consciousness beyond the ordinary. Sometimes the term cosmic consciousness has been used to describe a state in which awareness seems to embrace all creation, not in a detailed sense, but in an interior affirmation of unity and oneness. In the East, the state of consciousness is given such names as liberation, bliss, nirvana, illumination. And various systems of yoga are designed to help the aspirant to achieve it. I think from time to time all of us must be aware of moments of inspiration, flashes of insight or intuition, or an inner peace and serenity. And this indicates that somewhere deep within our own consciousness, there is something more than we are ordinarily aware of. To recognize this possibility doesn't mean that we are suggesting an escape from life, the realities of life here, but rather by realizing that only part of ourselves is expressing itself here, then we can tap the riches of our own nature and thus bring greater wisdom and understanding into our actions, reactions, decisions, and help us to become more whole, integrated human beings, acting from the center rather than from the circumference. Now, with the aid of this chart, I'm sorry that perhaps the letters aren't quite big enough for people at the back, but I will explain it as I go along. I would like to share with you some of the concepts presented in the Theosophical philosophy, which I find extremely helpful, and I hope you will. These help me in trying to understand the nature of man and the field of the expansion of awareness. Now, what I'm trying to offer is in no way dogmatic. The ideas are drawn from the metaphysical system outlined in The Secret Doctrine by H.P. Blavatsky, that much maligned but great woman. This is beyond the realm of scientific proof, and yet it is a system which is logical and reasonable, and it can be tested by one's own experience. According to the system of the Secret Doctrine, the solar system is manifested in seven divisions or states of matter in varying rates of vibration, and these divisions are called planes. But they could equally be called spheres, as they are everywhere. It is said that the finer states of matter interpenetrate the grosser and extend beyond them as though in concentric rings, so that the higher the rate of vibration, the finer it is, the state of matter, the more inclusive it is. Now, it is said that each of these fields is also planes, is also a field of consciousness, which becomes more veiled as the matter becomes more gross. Although in no sense to be taken literally, these planes, for the purposes of study, are often shown in diagrammatic form as levels, as levels one upon the other like shelves, the densest being at the bottom and the finest being at the top. And it is said, and this is divided into seven levels, as I said. Now, there is subdivision here and here. They are not separate planes. They're just subdivisions. So we have one, two, three, four, five, six, seven planes of existence. As I've already mentioned earlier, man is described as being, in his ultimate essence, a fragment of divine consciousness, emerging from the one life as a fragment or a unit of divine consciousness, which has the term given to it, monad, which means simply unit, a unit of consciousness. This then is the God in man. In order to unfold his godlike powers to the fullest capacity, it is suggested that he projects part of himself into these five lower planes while always retaining his roots in the spiritual, universal, all-self, the all-embracing spirit and life of the universe. And these planes have been variously classified and named, and I don't expect you to remember the technical names. I'll just read them out for those who are interested, but I'm going to deal with consciousness, which doesn't involve these names. But the names given technically is the monad plane, the monadic plane, or plane of Atma, Buddhi, Manas, astral, and physical. Now, each of these planes, it is suggested, has a corresponding level of consciousness. And we're talking about expanding consciousness, so we're going to deal mainly with these terms here. There is the monad, which is the God in man. There are the spiritual qualities of will, wisdom, intuition, and intelligence. And the mind's principle is dual, and so it is divided between intelligence and the thinking principle, the analyzing mind, and emotion and sensation. The monad then is the God in man, and in projecting into the lower planes is described as a trinity, combining the spiritual qualities of will, wisdom, intuition, and intelligence. This trinity is a reflection of the divine trinity and is the highest spiritual in man, immortal and undying, the true spiritual self. Now this spiritual self in turn, so it is suggested, projects itself into the lower phenomenal worlds to appear as a human being, taking on vestures of concrete mind, the analyzing thinking principle, emotion or feeling, and a physical body. This is the personality that we know, that is born, develops, grows old, and dies. It is mortal. This is the immortal self, this is the mortal self. It is said that at death, this personality gradually disintegrates, withdrawing back into the consciousness withdrawing back into itself, absorbing the essence of its earthly experience. And then after a time it projects itself again into the phenomenal world for further experience in another life and in another body. It may be a black body, a white body, a brown body, or a yellow body in another culture, in another sex. Now this gives us a whole new view of man and a whole new view of our relationships with each other and a whole new view of the reality of brotherhood, because we are all experiencing all cultures and all types of experience in many ethnic groups. Over many lives then, through the evolutionary process, this higher self is awakening to its full potentiality and consciousness, drawing into itself all the lessons learned during earthly existence. In this lower realm is the field of the unconscious. It is from there that arise dreams, fantasies, and psychedelic experiences. It is the realm of the psyche. It is also the realm of extrasensory perception, clairvoyance, and so on. Now it means that those types of experiences do not arise in the higher self, but they arise in the psyche, which is part of the mortal self, the unconscious, what is sometimes called the psychodynamic field. Now most of us are functioning and alive only in this part of ourselves, in the personality. So only a part of our true self is expressing itself, and here is the great silent majority. Silent, untapped, unused, waiting to be awakened, so to have the channel, as it were, opened up so it can be tapped. When we are able to awaken ourselves to the reality of the inner self, then it is suggested we will become fully awakened human beings with no break in consciousness between the higher and the lower. Now I mentioned that these two planes, at the level of mind, there is a duality. And this is the, as it were, the bridge between the spiritual levels and the phenomenal levels. there is, as it were, a bridge that crosses between the two. The spiritual and the phenomenal joined together at the level of mind. This is thought as being twofold, the higher representing creative intelligence, the lower representing the mental, concrete, fact-gathering, analyzing mind. So here, as I said, is the bridge between the upper levels of the spiritual being and the lower levels of phenomenal existence. Most of us do not cross this bridge, and so we have apparently two selves, like the two birds on a tree, which I mentioned earlier. And yet both are part of the whole man. Man exists at every level simultaneously, here and now. Therefore, to experience spiritual awareness means to expand, or to keep to the diagrammatic picture, to raise the focus of consciousness into the higher spiritual levels which are within and about us here and now. While we talk of expanding upwards, which gives an idea of spiritual flight, we could equally talk of flashes from the spiritual self coming down to the brain, or flowing outward from within and flooding the consciousness with illumination and light. Each way it is only a word picture, not to be taken, this diagram, not to be taken literally, of course. It is a word picture to help us to grasp the process in our minds. Sometimes this expansion occurs briefly in moments of inspiration and intuition. It may come through forms of yoga, by stilling the mind and crossing over. It happens in mystical experience, when there is an exaltation, a flowering of consciousness. In all these ways and many others, man is tapping his own spiritual roots, which spring from the one divine life. In the levels above the personality, there are no barriers of the little self, so there is achieved a sense of oneness and unity. And although we have three lines here to show this trinity, these are not containing lines. There is a sense of expansion at this level, not of containment, and so don't take that as any sense of barrier. Of course, at that level too, there is no sense of color or distinction, and this is where our true brotherhood lies, because we all have our roots in the one life, the one consciousness. Now, according to Occult's statements, consciousness can either expand gradually from the lowest to the highest, step by step, or it can take leaps upward. Again, I'm using diagrams, not literally. In addition, it is said that this higher triad can reflect itself in the lower, as if you turn that over like a mirror and it reflected into the lower. And of course, in that case, the physical action may be stimulated by spiritual will, high emotion and intuition are reflected in each other, and thought may be translated into abstract concepts. Now, although this expansion of consciousness into spiritual levels is often swift and immediate, and therefore difficult to grasp, nevertheless, we can find examples to help us to grasp how the soul may be flooded with light through different methods of expansion, which I've mentioned. And I would like just to consider a few examples with you. I suggest, first of all, we take a mystical experience where the consciousness seems to have started at the physical level but through the sensory awareness. There is an emotional response through an upliftment through an appreciation of nature's beauty. The mind and memory come into play. The abstract mind is stirred, and gradually there is experienced a state of absorption and communion with the universe itself. We have these words of Richard Jefferies. He said, "I was utterly alone with the sun and the earth. Lying down on the grass, I thought of the earth's firmness. I felt it bear me up. Through the grassy couch, there came an influence as if I could feel the great earth speaking to me. I thought of the wandering air, its pureness, which is its beauty. The air touched me and gave me something of itself. By all these I prayed. I felt an emotion of the soul beyond all definition. Having drunk deeply of the heaven above and felt the most glorious beauty of the day, I now became lost and absorbed into the being of existence of the universe. I felt down deep into the earth under and high above into the sky and further still to the sun and stars. Still further beyond the stars into the hollow of space, and losing thus my separateness of being, came to seem like a part of the whole. There is a description of cosmic consciousness. Such an experience means that he has penetrated the barriers of form, of time and space, of differentiation and limitation of his own mind, and thus achieved the true mystic experience. This, of course, is not something outside of one. It is an interior, subjective experience, and yet still very real. To put it in technical terms, consciousness would have moved from sensory awareness, infused with emotion, into the realm of thought, and then, as thinking ceased, into these abstract and spiritual realms beyond. We're reminded of Plato's concept of reaching up into heaven by the steps of a ladder, passing from the images of physical beauty into the realm of abstract and absolute beauty. To take an example of the second method, whereby consciousness seems to leap directly into spiritual awareness without passing through all these gradual states and in a way bypassing the mind altogether, we have these words of Tennyson. More than once when I sat all alone, the mortal limit of the self was loosed and passed into the nameless, as a cloud melts into heaven. And yet no shade of doubt, but utter clearness, and through loss of self, the gain of such large life as matched with ours was some to spark, unshadowable in words. Reminds us too of the Zen koans, where through trying to pierce through a contradiction, a paradox, one takes a leap if one solves it into the nameless, the formless world. Even in the execution of sporting prowess with physical skill brought to its highest pitch, it is possible to experience a change of awareness. Here's a description of a former Australian surfing champion, world champion, Australian Midget Farrelly. And this happened to him at Currumbin Beach in Queensland. I was sliding off the peak into the deep water when suddenly I felt I could keep going and going, pushing on and on as though there was no end to it anywhere. You go into oblivion. Suddenly all your life is there in this long, long stretched out wave. You're removed from the past. Everything that has been in your mind has become immaterial. Nothing matters any longer. But you and the board and the wave and this instant of time. Many mystical experiences seem to take their flight from some expression of higher emotion, such as love and response to beauty and adoration. And these are examples whereby the spiritual consciousness is reflected between emotion and the intuitional level. There is a merging of these two states without, apparently, the use of the mind. It seems to occur in nature mysticism. And we have the testimony from Sir Francis Younghusband, who described an experience which he had in the Himalayas. He said, "I felt I was seeing deep into the heart of things. I had a curious sense of being literally in love with the world. In my exceptionally receptive mood, I was directly experiencing the genius of nature in the very act of inspiring and vitalizing the whole. I was seeing the divinity in the heart streaming like light and heat through every part of nature, and with the dominating forcefulness of love, lifting each to its own high level. Now, this same movement of unity and love comes in the more introspective type of religious mysticism. Jacob Boehmer, the great Bohemian mystic, has described this experience. He said, "Suddenly my spirit did break through, even into the innermost birth of Genitur the deity, and there I was embraced with love, as a bridegroom embraces his dearly beloved bride." Now coming to another method, whereby the higher mind is reflected and merged into the lower mind, and so there is a crossing of the bridge here, we're reminded of the teaching of Pythagoras that the study of numbers is a way of approach to pure truth. Plato also said this about geometry. He said geometry leads the soul towards truth. To illustrate this type of expansion of consciousness, we have the example, an extraordinary example, of Arthur Koestler when in prison during the Spanish Civil War. He said that he was scratching mathematical formulae on the wall of his cell and trying to remember how to derive the formula of the hyperbola, but couldn't remember. Then he tried the ellipse and the parabola, and this time he was successful. And he says this was a method that gave him great satisfaction. And he quotes, "And then for the first time, I suddenly understood the reason for the enchantment. The scribbled symbols on the wall represented one of the rare cases where a meaningful and comprehensive statement about the infinite is arrived at by precise and finite means. The infinite is a mystical mass shrouded in a haze, and yet it was possible to gain some knowledge of it without losing oneself in treacly ambiguities. The significance of this swept over me like a wave. The wave had originated in an articulate verbal insight, but this evaporated at once, leaving in its wake only a wordless essence, a fragrance of eternity, a quiver of the arrow in the blue." Of course, there are many other statements where people have given testimony of mystical insight. All of them seem to be a ways to realization. Long ago, the Lord Buddha said, "Realization itself is an inner experience. It shines out with clear light spontaneously. You see all, you know all, for you are all." Now, the experiences that I've described to show this movement of consciousness have come mainly through mystical flashes, that is, spontaneously. And they demonstrate that other states of consciousness are possible. And I venture to suggest that there's no one here today who hasn't had some type or touched by the mystical experience. Something has stirred in you spontaneously. When you have been uplifted by the sight of a beautiful landscape, an exquisite flower, the star-filled heavens, you have looked at a mountain snow-capped and sheathed with clouds, you have seen a beautiful work of art, or you have listened to a great symphony, you have been pondering upon a deep thought, and a new insight has come to you unbidden. It is also probable that in the creative arts themselves, the inspiration arises from some deeper region of awareness. The work of art, the poem, the symphony, though they must be expressed in techniques of mind and form, derive their unique quality from some deeper level which makes them come alive. Now, we don't need to wait for such experiences to come like that in a spontaneous manner to suddenly appear from the blue. There are ways in which we ourselves can begin the process of inner expansion. One way to begin is through abstract thought and speculation, philosophizing, pondering, developing a sense of wonder. To do this is to cross the bridge from the analyzing thought into the synthesizing abstract level, so that the mind may be open to the more creative side of one's being, which ordinarily has so little chance to express itself. Apart from that, there are various forms of meditation, both from Western and Eastern sources, which can help us to begin this art of self-exploration. And each time what is prescribed is the gradual development of a power of inner silence and attention, a stilling of the mind, emerging into the greater self. One of the most valuable methods, I think, for this purpose is that which is incorporated in the system of Raja Yoga, which was prescribed as long ago as 3 centuries BC by the great Indian sage Patanjali. And of course it can be used by a person of Christian or any other faith. He gave 3 steps by which one can move into this inner state, and he called them concentration, meditation, and contemplation. This involves setting aside a few moments each day for communion with the self in the silence, free from interruption. First, there is the withdrawal of the mind from the world around by concentration on some chosen object. For instance, it can be a flower or some great concept such as beauty or truth or an aphorism. Begin by concentrating on that object or idea or aphorism, and then gradually deepen your absorption into the very heart of the object. Forms and words and images then can drop away, for the mind is pondering, wondering, knowing in a higher sense than the usual analytical knowledge that comes through the ordinary use of the mind. Then, when the mind has been brought to that state of absorption, then just drop the object, the flower, whatever, or the idea, drop it completely, leaving the mind in a poised state of stillness, of awareness. Now, this is not a negative state. This is something that you're in control of, because you are directing the process. In that moment, when there is an apparent vacuum, the mind empty of images and biases and prejudices, of anticipations and memories, there can come an intimation from within oneself, a real expansion of awareness, because you're opening up the passage between the higher and the lower. Such experience can deepen and grow if one perseveres in the practice. This will be translated into new insight and serenity in dealing with the problems of daily life, in one's work, in one's relationship with others. Because more of the whole man will begin to function. The higher self will have an opportunity to be more operative through the personality. So this isn't escaping from life and its responsibilities. The individual does not lose control of his own consciousness. He is sharpening his own innate powers. Meditation, of course, of this type and other types need not be confined to the special moments set aside for that purpose each day. We can have moments of heightened awareness as we walk along the street, as we watch spring arrive in the garden, as we look at a sunset, even as we go about our daily work. The process of self-discovery is a continuous one. And this isn't just daydreaming, but means bringing into the ordinary daily routines qualities of the spirit and tapping our hidden resources. Now, we've just been considering some factors when trying to understand the working of consciousness from the point of view of the theosophical philosophy, and there's a great deal more. I've just touched upon them. Yet even what I have suggested this afternoon indicates how complex man is, how much more of ourselves we have yet to tap and to stir into action. This is part of the third object of the Theosophical Society, which encourages the investigation of man's latent powers. Not just the powers of the psyche. These are the real hidden powers of man, the spiritual self, which is rooted in the all-self, the life of the universe. Even though for the purposes of study this afternoon, we have referred to the mechanism of man's consciousness, we should never forget, although we speak of different levels, that he is a whole, he is one. And eventually, in the course of evolution, he will become fully awake at every level, at will, at every moment of time, not just at rare moments, then he will be the perfect man and achieve the stature of the fullness of Christ, because he is, God is in him, and God will be fully awakened in him, the Christ consciousness. Now, I would just like to stress that although we have been talking about the study in a technical way, the wondrous moment of inner expansion cannot be described simply by analyzing it. I can't show you it just by looking at a chart. I can talk about it, but its beauty and mystery must be experienced by each one for himself. We can only know the flight of the spirit by our own direct interior expansion of consciousness. Before I close, I would just like to suggest a simple yet valuable form of meditation which can be used for the purpose of trying to explore the self and realize the real self. If you're doing it by yourselves at home, you would sit quietly with your eyes closed, perfectly relaxed, leaving aside your anxieties and pressures, and in a state of silence, mentally affirm, "My physical body is relaxed, at ease, quiet." There would be a period when you would realize the relaxation and quietness of your body, realizing that you yourself are not your body, but it is your instrument. Then you would affirm, "My emotions are quiet, gentle, happy," realizing again that I am not my emotions, but they are instruments through which I express love, affection. "My mind is quiet, still, calm, serene. It reflects the peace of the spiritual self," realizing again that I am not my mind, but is an instrument for the use of the self. And then comes the affirmation, "I am that spiritual self. That self am I." An affirmation of the reality of the spiritual self. Feel the innermost center of your being as a point of consciousness. Feel it as a center through which power from the all self may flow. Feel your whole consciousness focused at that point. Feel radiant, pure, subtle, eternal, immortal. Then, still expanding your consciousness, affirm yourself as one with the self in the universe. "I am one with the self, the life of the universe." And then think of the spirit or essence of the universal consciousness radiating outwards so that its blessing may be shared with all around. This is a slow process. I'm going through it quite quickly now, mentioning it. And then returning to normal awareness, let the reality of the spiritual self, which you have experienced, illumine your mind, harmonize your emotions, strengthen your body. Now you are ready for the tumult and problems and work of the day with a new serenity and an inner strength.